welcome to the Jesuit Border Podcast. This podcast explores the humanitarian response along the U.S.-Mexico border from a Catholic perspective. My name is Brian Strasburger.
And I'm Joe Noya. We're with the Del Camino Jesuit Border Ministries, located in the Diocese of Brownsville, Texas.
This podcast aims to humanize the migrant experience by sharing stories from our ministry and highlighting some of the amazing work that people are doing along the border and throughout the country.
The Jesuit Border Podcast is edited and produced by the Jesuit Conference of Canada and the U.S. and hosted by the Jesuit Post. Let's begin.
Vamos!
In this episode, we're going to talk about the tangible dimension of our faith.
We will be interviewing Susan Bigelow Reynolds, who is an assistant professor of Catholic Studies at Emory University. Stay tuned for that, but first, we want to share a little bit about the tangible dimension of our faith, or as we like to call it, stuff and things. One of our favorite things in our Catholic faith is holy water. It's become a new addition to our ministry here on the border. Father Flavio Bravo joined our mission in December of 2022, and it was his idea to bring a couple of bottles of holy water and have them at our Masses when we visit migrant camps and shelters and to put them to use after Mass.
Big hit.
Big hit. I mean, it was like, from the very first day, like when we'd finish up Mass and we'd say, okay, now what we're going to do is we're going to go around and bless people with holy water. Turns out people love holy water. I think specifically of the times when we're at the Humanitarian Respite Center, or the HRC as we call it, which is a shelter in McAllen, Texas, run by Catholic Charities. It's a place that can often have a lot of people in it because they're arriving, having been processed by Border Patrol, and they're making transportation arrangements to get to their final destination where they've got friends or family or sponsors ready to receive them. And it's a chaotic space because at any hour of a day, new people might be arriving and some people who are there might be leaving. So we arrive and often ask people to clear out a little bit of a space where we can set up a folding table that becomes our altar and put chairs set up for people to gather in. Well, some people inevitably come and sit on these chairs, but others remain where all their things are, where they've got kind of a mattress pad laid out on the ground. And so they're in the vicinity of our Mass, but maybe not sitting in the chairs right in front of us. But that doesn't mean they don't want to participate. And so that means they might be standing and sitting and praying with us from their spot. But in particular, it becomes most obvious to us when we get to the end of Mass and we start to sprinkle holy water on people, because then people come out of the woodwork. Everybody, whether they're sitting in the chairs in front of us and joining for their Mass, whether they're sitting on their mats, whether their kids are still sleeping, are anxious to have holy water sprinkled all over them. And so sometimes a parent from the very back of the HRC will be waving me down as I'm sprinkling holy water. And so I'll go back and go to be the back and sprinkle some holy water. And then she's pointing to her two-year-old child who's lying fast asleep and says, oh, make sure to sprinkle some holy water on her too. And so, you know, you try to sprinkle some holy water on the child without jarring them from their sleep because something wet is dripping on their forehead all of a sudden. But it's a beautiful way for us to share this sacramental part of our faith, holy water that, of course, reminds us of our baptism and how God continues to bless us, not only at our baptism, but all the days of our life.
I just think of this one time also in this other shelter we visited, how I could be planning to go make the rounds sprinkling holy water, but I don't make it more than, say, 5 feet away from where I'm standing, because people just swamping you, just kind of coming up, wanting that holy water. And yeah, it's a powerful, powerful thing.
That's right. They'll come find you whether you're looking for them or not. But holy water, of course, isn't the only thing that people are drawn to and interested in when we're talking about the stuff and the things, the tangible dimension of our faith.
No, it isn't. I'm thinking of rosaries. Rosaries are just a big deal. And back to the center in McAllen, where the holy water story was taking place, there's this medicine counter, you know, where, you know, sometimes I'll work and people come up, you know, getting ibuprofen, getting Tylenol, sometimes getting some hygienic stuff. And it's a constant line of people, always, always needing stuff because there's such need. And this boy comes up and he asks for a rosary. And I don't have a rosary. I don't have like a prescription bottle of over-the-counter rosaries. That doesn't even make sense.
So it's not like it's not cough syrup, ibuprofen, rosaries.
We got rosaries. No, it's just medicine and tubes of deodorant. They come in tubes, and so I go out to try and find a rosary, and I find a little pack of some rosaries that have been like tied together. So I want to do right by the guy as well. So I want to have these rosaries blessed. So I go over to you, and you're sitting down as right during the Psalms during the Mass, and I kind of sneak by
in the middle of Mass. Worth noting here. Yeah. Just want to make sure we got that. Yeah. This is in the middle of Mass.
It's a chaotic place. I go up, and you kind of surreptitiously bless the rosaries, and I give one to the kid, and then immediately, these are like 14 rosaries. I'm done with them in like 2 seconds. Well, word kind of starts spreading that, oh, some people got rosaries. So more people kind of come, and then I have to bother you again.
That's right.
Like finding more rosaries and having you bless them. Thankfully, you're not doing like a Eucharistic prayer right now in the moment. Yeah,
I still haven't found the part of the rite where it says, and then you turn to your right and bless the rosaries of the guy next to you.
So you do that, which is very kind of you. And I'm 2 seconds and I'm done. Well, again, now there's even more people with rosaries. So now even more people with the rosaries. So I just have to go and just find a big old box of rosaries. And same deal. And this time I last about 4 seconds with the rosaries. But what I love about this whole thing so much is not just the demand for rosaries and the demand for something tangible, but the setting of it all. Here's this boy that comes to a medicine counter where people look for something to aid their suffering, where people look for healing, and he asks for a rosary. And there's just something so appropriate about that, of someone wanting a rosary from a medicine counter. There's just a kind of a poetic connection there.
There's something to that about the sense of healing that we get even from the tangible dimension of our faith, the way that it speaks to us and communicates a certain message. And in some case, that's a message of feeling safe and secure. You know, I think that's a big part of the reason why people are drawn to the rosary, as they're drawn to Mary, as someone that they can turn to, especially in times of crisis, in times of need. There are other signs, of course, that are remarkable about our faith, and that reminds me of a time we were celebrating Mass recently in Senda 2. Senda 2 is one of the shelters in Reynosa, Mexico. It's like the most bare bones shelter that we see. It's basically a concrete wall built around a couple of fields, and people are living in tents exposed to the elements, and it's just really, really difficult conditions. Sometimes the sanitation system's working, sometimes it's not. And we started celebrating Mass there at Senda 2 in April of this year, going once a week on Thursdays and celebrating Mass just under one of the kind of bigger tarps where the kind of like the dining area where people line up to get served food daily. And so we started setting up a table there and some chairs and celebrating Mass. And usually when we get there, the first thing we do is plug in our speaker and start playing some religious music. And that kind of lets people know around the camp that Mass is coming and Mass is going to start soon. And then we can take the time to set up, and maybe one of us will even go around and visit people and pass by their tents or whatever to kind of let them know that Mass is going to start soon. Inevitably, the playing of music attracts a lot of children too. So a ton of kids will start gathering because they just want to see what's going on, and they're interested by the music and kind of curious. Well, sometimes they stick around for the Mass, but sometimes as you start to get into the readings and progress through the Mass, they might lose interest and just get up and run off because they've got something else that they think will be maybe more entertaining, let's say. But I'm just remembering, as we're talking about the tangible dimension of our faith this time, that in the middle of Mass, two little girls who are sitting right up front, they just kind of pop up and just give a smile and a wave and dart off. And, you know, truth be told, I really didn't think much of it because that happens all the time. But, you know, 5 to 10 minutes later, the two of them come back from directly where they've come, but they're holding on to something. They've got these two little crosses.
These, like, handmade crosses that are, like, the wood of the crosses are really, I mean, it's trash, like pieces of trash of like chipped off wood from like a wall or from something or who knows what. But it's and they're held together by broken shoelaces and what do you call those things, like the little
hair ties.
Yeah, mm-hmm. like held together. Yeah, so it's just like they take some junk from the ground and they make these crosses from them. And just kind of like turning it from like stuff on the ground that redeeming them, if you will.
Mm-hmm, which is particularly potent, obviously, in the image of the cross. And so they handed them to me in the middle of Mass and smiled and returned to their seats. And so I did the only thing that felt natural, which was just to set them on our altar next to the little crucifix that we have there already. And I think it was a potent symbol for me and for us about the redemption that can come to us through our faith, through the cross, and how, you know, a little piece of trash can turn into something, a symbol of our faith. And you know what? Ever since that day, we've been putting out those crosses on our altar.
Mm-hmm.
And so stuff and things matter in our faith. That tangible dimension is important. And I think there are a few people that notice these things more astutely than today's guest, Susan Bigelow Reynolds. She actually came to visit us here in Brownsville for Holy Week last year, and she's going to share some deep reflections on the tangible. So stay tuned for our interview now with Susan Bigelow Reynolds. We are thrilled to welcome to our episode today Susan Reynolds. She's an assistant professor of Catholic Studies at Emory University's Candler School of Theology. And as a theologian and ethnographer, she examines the intersection of ecclesiology and lived Catholicism in context of diversity, marginality, and suffering. Thank you for joining us for this episode, Susan.
I'm so thrilled to be here.
It's really our pleasure. We're glad to have you on the podcast. And you know, you happen to be the first theologian that we've interviewed in all of the history of the Jesuit Border podcast. So I wondered if, to get things started, if you could just share with our listeners a little bit about what inspired you to study theology and how you've found your focus and research area as you've grown into your work.
That's a great question. And wow, what an honor, the inaugural theologian. What propelled me to study theology in graduate school actually was my experience of living in Brownsville, living actually very close to where you all live, going to the same parish that you all serve at in Brownsville. I moved there in 2009. I was part of the Alliance for Catholic Education program out of the University of Notre Dame, and I was teaching at a small Catholic school in Harlingen, and my community mates were teaching at various Catholic schools in Brownsville. And at the time we lived right on Military Highway, right on basically the road that tracks right along the border. We lived about a quarter mile in from the border, but it was hard to tell how far we lived in exactly because there wasn't a wall there when we moved there. We could see probably straight into Mexico from our front yard, and we would go on runs to the river and back. It was this very contiguous existence. We'd go to Matamoros for dinner, you know, to visit students, to go out. And then one day in the late fall in 2009, we noticed these enormous iron posts down, you know, a ways down from our front yard, kind of looking into the distance, and so dumb. We were like, what's that? What are they doing? What is that? And very soon we found out they were building the border wall, what's now sort of the feature of that geographical land space, this towering multi-story iron rusty wall was built before my eyes in front of my front door over the course of a couple of months. And all of a sudden there was a wall where there wasn't a wall before. And it changed me in a certain way. And when my time in the ACE program was finished, I realized I wanted to study theology because I wanted to think harder about what that sort of a barrier meant. And what it means to be church across borders, what it means to be church in spite of borders.
You're continuing to do good theological research, and part of that is what brought you to visit us here in Brownsville just earlier this year. So maybe you could share a little bit about what it was, what it is that you're researching now, and how that inspired your trip to come see us.
Absolutely. The research that I'm working on now actually grew out of, again, out of my experience as a very young woman living in Brownsville. One of my more powerful memories from my second year in Brownsville when I was living there was some of the Holy Week practices, especially the Stations of the Cross that was through the streets of Cameron Park. And so I always dreamed of writing a book that looked at the ways that communities sort of on the edges of both society and the church practice the Stations of the Cross publicly. And so one of the first stops I made after I received grant funding to do that project, thank you, Louisville Institute, was Brownsville. And of course, in some way, I'm always just looking for an excuse to come back to the Valley. But it was sort of this return because I had experienced the power of Good Friday there before. And so I was grateful to be able to bring a student of mine along with me, my student Sarah Buter, who's about to leave to become a Maryknoll missionary for 3 years in Central America. And the two of us came and visited you all because you were so generous in sharing your time and your community with us for that week. And Sarah accompanied Brian to Reynosa during Holy Week, and I accompanied Flavio and Louis to the migrant camp in Matamoros and was able to celebrate along with them and the folks there, the liturgies of the Triduum. It was incredibly powerful.
I've been so moved now two years in a row down here of celebrating Holy Week and the way the liturgy in these marginalized communities with migrants at the border, at a shelter or camp or plaza, how the symbols of the liturgy take on a life that I just never have seen them have before. Because in the churches that I've gone to as a kid, even as a Jesuit, just growing up, they just don't take on the same meaning. There's a beauty to it always, no matter where you celebrate these liturgies, but I'll never forget that first year celebrating Holy Week in the Plaza of Reynosa. You know, when you go down to wash someone's feet and they're in a migrant camp, you know, you just get much closer to that experience and what it meant for Jesus to wash someone's feet, right? When we decided to do incense there for the very first time during Holy Week, and it was like, I mean, the place where we celebrated Mass in that plaza was 15 feet or less from the porta potties that service that camp. And it was not uncommon to just celebrate Mass amid the smell of those porta potties present. And that's when that incense, when you started shaking it and it started just, the aroma of it actually started to fill your nostrils. It was like, holy cow. Like, it's part of what I love about our faith, about our Catholic faith. It's so tactile, right? It's those kind of images. One of the things that I loved that you shared, you know, just to highlight, you were back at BC recently. You got to give the Dan Harrington lecture. You received Boston College's School of Theology and Ministries Alumni Distinguished Service Award. But as I heard, you started that talk with an image from Good Friday and an image that influences and speaks to the way that you do theology. So I wondered if you could share that image and what it was that spoke to you about it so much.
Be happy to. I would say that the Catholic stuff is got to be my favorite thing about being Catholic. When I teach Catholic history, I teach with a lot of things. As part of that, I became sort of enchanted with what we were packing each day. I shared all of my photos, I think, with you guys, and I'm sure you guys thought it was very funny how many photos I had of just like the trunk of the car each day, because it was this just assortment of things that were either liturgical or being liturgically reappropriated things that were borrowed, things that were old, things that were searched for. I remember when I was accompanying Louis and we had to go on this kind of wild goose chase for hosts before Mass one day. And even that to me felt like very dear. But I remember we were packing up the trunk on Good Friday. And, putting in the, hymnals and the, vestments and this and that and all of these things. And then at the very last minute, Louis and Flavio grabbed all of the flattened Amazon boxes that were against the wall of your kitchen. When I first arrived and knocked on your door, there was like a towering stack of donations that had just come in from your Amazon wish list. And in those boxes had, as we all do, what do you do with all the boxes from the mail? Were just sitting flattened against your kitchen wall. And at the last minute, Louis and Flavio shoved them in the trunk. And I'm like, okay, interesting choice. I wonder what these are going to be. And when we got to the camp and we're setting up for Mass, Louis, we laid him on the ground in front of the makeshift altar, which was made out of some stacked wooden pallets. And of course, the Good Friday liturgy begins in silence as the priests or concelebrants process to the front, to the altar, and lie prostrate in front of the altar and in front of the crucifix. And even in a normal parish setting, right? Like it's very jarring. I always kind of forget about it right before we start on Good Friday. And it always kind of surprises me. And it freaks me out in like the best way. It's very powerful. But similarly in the camp, we started in silence, and Louis and Flavio sort of process forward from the crowd that sort of gathered in a semicircle and lie prostrate in front of the altar on these Amazon boxes, right? On these flattened cardboard boxes. And this is the same ground that everybody has spent, a really unforgiving night on. And their shoes are covered in mud. and of course they're lying on their stomachs. So their shoes are facing up. And so just this image of these two priests lying face first in the mud on top of cardboard boxes with their shoes just caked in mud, just felt like it spoke to something that felt very true about just sin and humanity and in the ways that liturgy, not completely, but in a real way, has the capacity to make space for a kind of solidarity. To me, it was very, very powerful. And it was an image that I really will not forget.
It is a powerful image. In fact, I was kind of getting, I don't know, I feel like I kind of got a slight lump in the throat as you were talking about it.
Safe space to get a lump in your throat.
That's right. Yeah, right. Yeah, but it is incredibly powerful. And those images of seeing these priests do that. Are there any evocative images, though, that you see from the faithful in those moments? Those moments that kind of emphasize the dialogic aspect of the liturgy. We see the faithful responding or reacting in certain ways that was incredibly powerful for you. Was there a moment like that?
Oh, so many. I have three very young daughters. They're 4, 7, and 8. And whenever I'm away from home, I'm always thinking about my kids. And so I find that I kind of gravitate to mothers also. And when I was in the camp, the first thing that really surprised me and sort of shocked me when we first arrived was just how many young mothers, mothers of young children, and pregnant women are living in these camps. It was so a lot of the people that I spoke to most at length were mothers. There was one mother named Yunetsi. She is from Venezuela, and she had a 3-year-old daughter with her who was really, really sick. And she was wrapped in a blanket, but of course, like, the blanket is wet. She received a tent from the Jesuits the first day I was there. So that was beautiful, because the next day, at least, her daughter was waving from the tent, which was really sweet. But talking to her, she had recently arrived in the camp, and she's telling me about, you know, how they hiked through, you know, La Selva, the Darien Gap, and I'm just imagining, and, you know, and seeing her carry her daughter on, you know, during the Via Crucis on Good Friday. We did a Eucharistic procession again to the border the day before on Thursday, and she's carrying her. And this is a 3-year-old. I mean, 3-year-olds are big, you know, they're not babies, but this girl was so sick. She couldn't walk. And just, I just remember thinking that, and, you know, you just think weird kind of things. I mean, this wasn't strange, but this was the salient thing that entered my head, was that she looked like the most tired person I'd ever seen in my life. She reminded me of when you've just given birth and you haven't slept for like 72 hours and you're so tired that you're delirious. But she had to exist in this state with her daughter on her hip for months. And then to see her, you know, like, have her feet washed and her daughter's feet washed, which was also no small thing because it was kind of cold outside. So some people are like, is this going to be comfortable? Do I want my feet washed? But eventually nearly everyone did have their feet washed. And just to see her be cared for in some small way, but also like a way that sort of brought her into some kind of communion with like 2,000 years of people performing this ritual gesture. Like, that was very beautiful to me. It was these beautiful moments of feeling this deep interconnectedness of mothers and motherhood. Also just recognizing really just like the untellable level of bravery and courage and struggle that so many women are enduring right now in the hopes of saving their families.
I think it's helpful to paint that picture, share those stories, because that's not always the image that I think people have of migrants, right? You often think, okay, these are young, single men coming up looking for jobs or something like that. And that's there are young, single men who come to the United States seeking safety and security opportunities. That's not non-existent among the migrant population, but it's important to recognize and name and to see it and witness to it, I think, the presence of a lot of families with young children, pregnant women, who are among the many people who come, who travel, who leave their home country, often because of violent threats, things that are so terrifying that it propels you, even as a mother of young children, to take a 3-year-old, carry on your hip, and make this journey. You know, you don't do that lightly. You don't do that because you want to, you know, make sandwiches at the back of a restaurant, right? I mean, you do that because you are propelled forward by some very challenging and difficult circumstances, often in your home country, and you're looking for safety, you're looking for security, you're looking for a better life and a future for your child, as I think any parent can relate to, right?
And
I think
absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's important to share that, to paint that picture, because that's what the reality is of migration today, right?
And it's so important too, even because that's also the reality of men there, right? So I think often we kind of juxtapose these different groups, like, okay, well, you have these women in really desperate situations, their family's been threatened, they're, you know, they've been forced to leave, you know, we look at them with more sympathy, hopefully. But also, I mean, I talked to so many men, I'm thinking of one man in particular, His name was Alexander, and he had come alone. He was traveling with a small group of like four adults, but they weren't family. They were just sort of a cohort. And but he was doing this. He had left his he had to leave his family in order to sort of try and kind of be the first one out to find a place for his family to join him. He was talking to me about how, you know, he had three kids at home, and he too, he had hiked through the Darien Gap, and he described the experience of seeing a dead child during, you know, in the Darien Gap, you know, in this kind of horrific stretch of jungle, and just feeling like just physically so ill, as obviously as anyone would, but just all he could think about was his children. And he talked, at one point we were having a conversation, and he talked about like his first or second day having arrived in Matamoros, and he had gone to get like a couple, like a liter of soda. And on the way back to his encampment, this little girl who was seemed to be the same age as his daughter back home, came up to him and asked him if she came up to him with a cup, said, "Can I have a drink?" And he said he of course knelt down and opened his, you know, soda, which probably cost him like significant proportion of the spendable money that he had on him, and of course filled her cup and gave her a drink, and then just started sobbing. So it's like, this is, you know, even if we can't see it, like this is everyone's story. And that too, that's another, speaking of stories, like that's a story that really sort of haunts me, lives in my mind.
Man, you know, the stories you have, oh man, they're very evocative. Mm-hmm. They provoke a lot. And there's this, they kind of speak of like this deep need for redemption and restoration. And that makes me wonder, you know, we have so many images of heaven. Are there so many ways of understanding heaven, different ways of seeing heaven and thinking about it? Is there an image of heaven that particularly speaks to you?
Oh, that's a beautiful question. I mean, there are different moments in my everyday life that feel heavenly, right? But an image, one image from Matamoros that evoked a sort of heaven. So we had a sort of afternoon Easter vigil, and the incense in that particular mass, it was so beautiful because the thurible was hanging on a tree behind us. And then there was this kind of group of kids that sort of were hanging out, and the group grew, and they kind of at some point became kind of impromptu altar servers. And of course, like kids and me, you know, you love like fire, anything that's like a science experiment. And so the incense situation was like, oh yeah, like we all want to be sort of part of this. And so it was this very wonderful drawn out process because the kids were like all, you know, helping to stoke the flame or whatever. And it was lovely. But then, and that was, it was this kind of like joyful little mayhem for a while. But then, and this is another part in the liturgy, any liturgy, right? Not just in a migrant camp. Like this always makes me kind of like, oh gosh, this is beautiful. But it struck me in a particular way when the priest sort of incenses the book and the gifts and the concelebrant, and there's, you know, bows, da da da. I'm sure that's how they describe it in your classes, how to be a priest. There's bows, blah, blah. And do the thing. But then, of course, the priest comes around and incenses the community, and that always, I just get chills. And then the priest bows, and then the community bows, and it's just this beautiful moment of communion. But this day and in this time and place, Louis had the thurible, and folks were kind of in a semicircle around the makeshift altar, and so slowly, just almost person by person, incenses, like every person in this slow, deliberate, like unhurried way. And it was just the most dignifying thing I've ever seen in my life. This is where I start to cry. It was so beautiful. And I just, for me, that was a moment of heaven on earth, because it was this way of saying, you deserve to be bathed in a beautiful scent, right? You deserve to have your feet washed. You deserve to have, candles lit before you. You deserve music. You deserve prayer. I think we take a very utilitarian approach to the poor often, where it's like, well, let's fill some bellies first, which, like, yes, we should do that first. But I think often we're like, well, what, these people don't need prayer. They don't need liturgy. They need a new pair of shoes. They need clothes and a hot meal and a home. And yes to all of that. But like prayer and spirituality and God and beauty, like these are also human rights. And for me, that was like a little inbreaking, I think, of heaven on earth.
I think it's only appropriate that an image of heaven should move us to tears. And so I think that is a beautiful image to wrap our minds with and sit with as we pray for those heavenly moments in our life and reflect on those. You know, Susan, it's kind of crazy how our two lives have kind of run on these parallel tracks. So for our listeners, Susan and I both went to the same youth group parish, St. Thomas More, back in Denver, and overlapped for a year there. And then she lived in Brownsville and went to San Felipe Parish, which is the parish where we now live in Cameron Park and serve at that parish. And then when you were living in Boston at St. Mary of the Angels, which was the source of your book, People Get Ready, that was where I served as a deacon during my deacon year, during my theology studies in Boston. So I guess my closing question to you is simply, if you could just let me know the name of your parish you're at now so that I know where I'm headed sometime in the inevitable future.
St. Thomas More Jesuit Parish in Decatur, Georgia.
Oh,
so
my
it
goodness.
Is not unlikely that you whatever. But I'll set a place before you.
Well, I don't know when, but now I know. I could just let my provincial know. Hey,
yeah,
by
well,
the
I'll,
way.
I'll let you know. Big move I make, I'll let you know, because I know that you'll be there soon.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, when I went back to the School of Theology and Ministry at BC, in the spring, by then it was, oh, do you know Brian? So your reputation by then was, strong.
Well, that's great. And we can give a shout out to all those people, especially St. Mary the Angels, much yes. beloved by the two of us. And so I'm sure they're going to tune in and get to listen to this episode that brings the two of us together on a podcast.
They're big fans of the Jesuit Border podcast. They were all very excited to hear that we had just spent Holy Week together. Yeah.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you, Susan, for joining us for this podcast, for this interview, but most of all, for the incredible theology that you're doing, for witnessing to these realities, for reflecting on them through a theological lens. It's super valuable, important work, and we really love all that you do. You said you're always looking for an excuse to get back to Brownsville. Well, whenever you find one, look us up, let us know. We'd love to have you back.
Nothing would make me happier.
Well, that wraps up our episode for this week. Thanks for joining us.
Remember to subscribe to this podcast to hear more about the U.S.-Mexico border from a Catholic perspective. You can visit our website at delcamino.org.
If you're curious about Jesuit life or know someone who is, visit beajesuit.org to learn more about a religious vocation to the Society of Jesus.
This podcast is edited and produced by the Jesuit Conference of Canada and the U.S. and hosted by the Jesuit Post.
We'll see you next time on the Jesuit Border Podcast.
Que Dios los bendiga.